So this past week, as I spent far too much time on social media, and I read a bunch of posts related to the Bell Let's Talk campaign. And for those of you who might not know what that is, maybe you're smart enough to avoid social media. Hashtag Bell Let's Talk is a nationwide program designed and initiated by the phone company Bell to try, in their words, to break the silence around mental illness and support mental health all across Canada. And I've been really, truly touched by some of the posts that I've read. People who have bravely dared to make public their struggles with depression, anxiety, bipolar, or schizophrenia. People who have openly talked about how hard it is each day to swallow a pill. People who have named the traumas that they have endured and how lasting the impacts of those have been on their lives. It has been inspiring and eye-opening and truly beautiful to read some of these posts. And perhaps it hits a bit more closely to home this year as anxiety and depression have touched down more deeply into the life of our family and lately into the functioning of my own mind. And maybe as a result of that, I've been struck with our collective emphasis on being healthy, on obtaining or maintaining mental and physical well-being when all around us are signs that our world is in fact insane. Why are we striving to be well adjusted, whole and sane in a completely manic, chaotic, and maddened world? And what has contributed to why this world is so messed up? And what does Jesus have to say? Does he have anything to say to speak into this mental health crisis that we find ourselves in? And of course, it's not just a mental health crisis. We're in the midst of ecological collapse, political unrest, economic hardships, addictions, displaced peoples, and threatened species. And Joel Salatin, the self-described lunatic farmer, wrote a blog post this week on loneliness. And in it, he said that unless and until our broader culture realizes that we've become unmoored from what it means to be human, interacting with our nest, caring for our collective womb, we will be lonely, disoriented, and depressed. I think it might be helpful to remind ourselves that it was to a similar group of unmoored people to whom Jesus addressed when he declared over them these Beatitudes. When Jesus saw the crowds, he went up the mountain, and after he sat down, his disciples came to him. So this ragtag group, masses of people who are disheveled and dispirited, diseased people, begin to flock to Jesus, this one who heals, who performs wonders and miracles, and in their own desperation, they seek him out. And after Jesus had seen them, and I imagine that he really did see them, he gathers with his disciples on this hill, gazing out onto a sea of humanity, and begins to teach his disciples about who just really is blessed. Who is it that God, in fact, honors? And before I go further into that, I think it's worth noting that there's a long history of interpreting this list of Beatitudes as a sort of new law. This is, after all, the same mountain in which Moses had one point in time climbed and delivered the Ten Commandments, and many have concluded that this list is a description of the ideal Christian, and therefore it is our prescribed duty or obligation as followers of Jesus to become increasingly meek, mournful, justice-oriented peacemakers in the world. And in effect, it becomes another to-do list, another law to live by, more striving. And while none of those things or ways of being are bad, they are not at all appealing. Who in all truth would want to become poor and persecuted and mournful? I don't think that was the point of Jesus declaring these blessings. because Jesus was gazing out over a crowd of ordinary, rural, poor folk, people who by no means could live up to the law of their time. In no way could they meet the standards of acceptance that the religious authorities or imperial authorities had placed over them. These were people who were burdened, and to them, Jesus speaks blessing. He speaks honor. He speaks affirmation. This is not a to-do list. This is not a new set of laws for a people to live under the weight of. This was Jesus gazing out over a sea of humanity with the eyes of love and recognizing their deep losses, their longings and yearnings. He was noticing the ways they were powerless, the ways they were deprived or impoverished. He was seeing them, and he was calling them his beloved community. And it is right there that he proclaims that his kingdom is made available to them. The shalom of God, the flourishing of all created things, is made available to them. And audacious as it might sound, I think that offer stands to us today, for us today. Just as it was then, God's beloved community is and will always be with those of us who know that we are disheveled, diseased, weak, and poor. So what would our Beatitudes be today in this city and in this time? Perhaps they might begin something like this. Blessed are those who despair and worry about the future of the world. Blessed are those who work three jobs and can barely afford rent. Blessed are the single parents. Blessed are the addicts, which I'm quite convinced is all of us. Blessed are the angsty teenagers struggling to make sense of their identity. Blessed are the lonely. And so as a result of our place in community, of knowing that we belong, that we are blessed, we can begin to relax and be seen for what we are, with all of our longings and sorrows and areas of powerlessness. We can risk being exposed in our poverty, in our weakness, in our vulnerability, in our disheveled and diseased state. We don't have to cover it up or hide it. We don't need to be afraid to be seen for who we are, with all of our gifts and shadows, our sorrows and our longings. And this really does look foolish. God chose what is low and despised in the world, things that are not, to reduce to nothing things that are. And this may be a word of assurance and affirmation, but that there's more to the Beatitudes than blessing. There's also a vision into the mystery and hope of our future as well. On one hand, it's a proclamation of God's availability and presence to his beloved creation, but it's also a promise of a future, for they will be comforted. They will inherit the earth. This is a promise of hope for a struggling people. And to Jesus' disciples, whom he was directly talking to, these Beatitudes are also an invitation to live more deeply into the future that we are promised. It's not a to-do list, it's an invitation. If we dare to believe these things are actually true, that the meek shall inherit the earth, that those who mourn will be comforted sometime in the future, then we are invited to be participants on the journey toward making those promises a reality. So the movie Just Mercy was just released a few months ago based on the book by the lawyer Brian Stevenson. And he's a lawyer who works in the southern U.S. mostly with African American clients who are facing death row. It's an amazing story and a powerful book. And in an interview with Christianity Today, Stevenson talks a bit more about why he does the work that he does. And it's a long quote, but I want to quote it all because it's so good. What has defined my work over the last 35 years is this belief that each of us is more than the worst thing we've ever done. I genuinely believe that no one is just their worst act. If you tell a lie, you are not just a liar. If you take something, you are not just a thief. Even if you've killed someone, you are not just a killer. And justice requires that we know the other things that you are. It's easy to expect the worst part of you and just stay in that place because it takes work and faith and hope and belief and love to transcend some of the difficult and painful things we do to one another. I think that's what we're called to do. And in that respect, the work can be both ministry and advocacy at the same time. Brian Stevenson is living into a new kind of future and is leading the rest of us on that path. Matt and I have been watching episodes on the show called The Messiah, which is pictured behind me. And I won't go into detail about the show. It's very good. But there is one scene that has stuck with me. About halfway into the first season, there's a group of poverty-stricken Muslims who've been led out into the desert from Damascus into the Golan Heights, right up to the Israeli border. The group is starving and barely surviving, and they camp right out along a barbed wire fence. And on the other side of the fence sits the armed Israeli soldiers. And there's one character, a young boy named Jibril, who in a delirious state of starvation keeps seeing visions of his mother and this Jesus figure in the show named Al-Masa. And after seeing a bunch of these visions, he stands up feebly and slowly strips down. And in his naked, malnourished state, he slowly walks towards the fence, directly towards the guard who holds a gun up to Jibril's exposed chest. And the soldier is unable to shoot Jibril, precisely because he is unarmed and powerless. And so Jibril ends up leading the entire group of starving Muslims across the border, completely naked. In complete weakness, Jibril took a courageous step towards a future in which he hoped. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. This is also most fully embodied in Jesus, the ultimate model of the one who lived the spirit of the Beatitudes. And so what about us? We are not working with folks on death row in the southern U.S. or starving in the middle of the Golan Heights. What might a new kind of future mean for us? Well, firstly, I think our understanding of the Beatitudes might possibly change or inform what or who we think makes up a church community. Any spiritually healthy congregation, as Dallas Willard says, will more or less look like these brands plucked from the burning. If the group is totally nice, that is a sure sign that something has gone wrong. For here, are the foolish, weak, lowly, and despised of this world, whom God has chosen to cancel out the humanly great. Don't be offended, I include myself in that as well. We come together each week or throughout the week to remind ourselves that we are beloved, blessed children of God. And when outside this place, this gathering, we are told that we are too loud or too big, too irresponsible, too emotional, not good enough, not successful enough. We come together to remember ourselves to each other and to God. We tell and proclaim to each other those same words of Jesus, that we are blessed, loved, beloved. And this also means taking steps towards each other in our own brokenness and weakness. Steps and steps towards a hoped-for future. So what would it look like for our community to live more deeply into a vision of shalom, a vision of flourishing? What would it look like for us to move away from fear and despondency and entrapment and isolation into a creative and yet vulnerable vision of hope? Jean Vanier says that Jesus came to free us all by the gifts of his Spirit and calls us to a new life of the Beatitudes and of community. And I can't get away from quoting Jean Vanier in a sermon, but I love that he links the Beatitudes with community. In our weakness and blessedness, we come together. What if we dared to live more into the spirit of the Beatitudes, deepening our ties to community, even and especially in our brokenness? In beginning to know that we, in our complete nakedness, are loved by God and each other, then our lives begin to exude the gracious power of God. And then, perhaps, we can embody more of Oscar Romero's words, that even when they call us mad, when they call us subversives and communists and all the epithets they put on us, we know we only preach the subversive witness of the Beatitudes, which has turned everything upside down. Let's pray. God, may your kingdom of love, of flourishing, of hope, of assurance and affirmation come to us in this feeble community, and grant us courage and creativity to live more deeply into our promised future for all your creation.